Go ahead and call ready announcements. It looks as if the first case attorneys, Cortez versus Brown et al., have found the front tables. So that's a good thing. I will tell you that we have a high school class coming in to see the second argument. They heard that Mr. Mao was here and just couldn't resist. And so we're going to take a brief break between cases and let them come in so that we don't have disruption. The second case we'll be calling State of Texas versus Lerma, and we will call that officially after we have the break this morning. Those of you new to the third court, which I don't think any of you are, each side has allocated 20 minutes to argue. You've had the chance to get with the clerk and determine how you're going to split your time. I would also remind you that we have a lighting system to help you know when your time is up. When you see the yellow light, you have 2 minutes remaining. When the red light comes on, you need to look to the court to continue. You can finish answering whatever question you might be in the midst of, but look to us to go forward. You may be aware we have an audio recording system now, and so the case will be recorded. Audio will be put online within a few days after, and you can get on and download that for your record as well. By way of housekeeping, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone, pager, other thing that might go off and beep, distract our litigants, now would be a good time to turn it off. And with that, we will call Mateo Cortez versus Sandra Fletcher Brown et al., cause number 17365CV.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case concerns a trust, which under multiple provisions leaves a mother and father's assets, unremarkably, to their only child, Deborah Cortez. The case has been complicated by the unnecessary filing of a second suit in another state where more distant relatives want to take those assets for themselves. But the proper interpretation of the trust and the propriety of Texas sanctions that were based on that second filed out-of-state case are in this court's hands. I'd like to focus my remarks this morning on those two issues. All of the issues in this appeal arise from Article 8 of the subject trust, which governs final distribution of the trust assets. Article 8, which we've included in our oral argument exhibits at tab 8, comprises a series of progressive steps which are to be applied depending on the status of Deborah Cortez upon her second parent's death, which turned out to be her mother, Phyllis. Under paragraph A, we find two immediate and specific cash distributions, a specified amount to charities, and $50,000 to Deborah Cortez if she were alive and competent upon her mother's death. So under what circumstances do we advance to those next steps? Paragraph A2 tells us there are only two such circumstances. First, if Deborah was not living at the time of her mother's death. Or two, if Deborah was alive but legally incompetent. If you turn to tab B.
And that's the reading that the West Virginia court found that the lower court judge here ultimately sanctioned your other counsel on, correct? I mean, that's the interpretation that was argued that ended up being problematic.
No, Your Honor. The sanctions were based on our good faith interpretation of paragraph D.
The 35 limit?
The postponement provision, yes. But paragraph D was always argued in tandem with our assertion that Deborah Cortez, upon the death of her mother, was the sole beneficiary. And that occurs, of course, at paragraph A. But if we look at tab B and consider the first of the, or yes, tab B and consider the first of those circumstances in the left-hand column, we've provided sort of a more user-friendly illustration of the provisions. Let's look at the left-hand column. If Deborah were no longer alive when her mother died, the $50,000 gift lapses. We look to paragraph B, which provides for a continuing trust, clearly not applicable to a deceased Deborah. So then we progress to paragraph C to find alternate beneficiaries, and if any of them are under 35 at the time, we look to paragraph D, which provides a continuing trust in that case. We know that Deborah was alive when her mother passed away, so this scenario is clearly inapplicable. So now let's look at the second of those possibilities, that Deborah is alive but legally incompetent, in the right-hand column. Again, the $50,000 gift lapses. We turn to paragraph B, which now is applicable, establishes a continuing trust for the lifetime of Deborah in her incompetency. And upon her death, we again look to paragraph C to find the beneficiaries for the remainder. And again, we know that Deborah was not legally incompetent upon her mother's death, so this scenario is also inapplicable. But, and now let's look at the center column. beyond the immediate cash distributions. Paragraph A does not specifically tell us what was to happen if, upon the death of Deborah's second parent, Deborah was both living and competent, which was the case. Because there is no specific provision as to how the trust assets were to be distributed, we look to intestate succession. Deborah survived both of her parents. She was her mother's only descendant upon her mother's death.
Tell me again why B wouldn't apply in this situation. If she's alive and competent, why wouldn't B control?
Well, because the final sentence of paragraph A2 says, if Deborah is no longer living or is legally incompetent, then the $50,000 gift lapses and the remainder of the trust assets are distributed as follows. In other words, we never reach B unless one of those situations occurs. And in the case of her death before her mother, we skip B because we don't need the continuing trust.
But, so you're saying when it says shall be administered as provided below, that automatically that's referring to B and not something else in the trust document?
It's referring to all of those successive steps.
But the reason I ask that is because, you know, B says continuing trust for Deborah if our daughter Deborah is living on the date of death and the second one of us to die, which is exactly what happened, right? Then the remaining trust shall be administered as follows. So why wouldn't B apply?
Well, because the prefacing sentence about where how we're going to trigger any of those successive steps, and we can look to that at tab A, says that, let's see, if Deborah is not then living or is not legally competent, then this gift shall lapse, and the remainder of the trust estate shall be administered as provided below, referencing all of the successive steps below.
So under B, B makes some reference to her education. How would that have any meaning whatsoever if she's dead or incompetent?
Well, legal incompetency, of course, is a defined term. She may be requiring education even if she's not legally competent to manage her affairs. It also refers to incapacity. It's not defined in the trust other than as to a trustee or a settlor. But we can contemplate a scenario where Deborah might be legally incompetent and thus be provided for under the continuing trust, but still be able to sort of summon resources as she needed them from the trustee. But if she were incapacitated completely, for example, in a vegetative state, she wouldn't be able to do so. So that's not inconsistent.
But B actually, if B were to apply, then Deborah had an income provision and the ability to draw on the principal of the trust while she was living, right? So, I mean, wouldn't that be consistent with the remainder of the trust shall be administered as provided below? I mean, it seems to me that that's exactly what the trust is doing. It's saying, here's what happens if Deborah's alive at that time, regardless of incapacity or whatever may happen. Otherwise, how are we giving effect to B if we just skip it?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, we believe that the prefacing language means that this is an incompetency trust. Our opponents and I agree that on one thing, that it is for the lifetime of Deborah Cortez, but it's only triggered in the case of incompetency. And that makes sense because the $50,000 gift is taken away if she's incompetent. We leave it with her if she is competent. So there's a distinction there. That makes sense because under B, we're providing for an incompetent Deborah in a more measured and metered form.
Ms. Taylor submitted to us some Brian Garner expertise on commas. I thought she'd been talking to my staff attorneys, but apparently it relates to this case. Do you want to refute or give us your position on whatever provision it is that the comma makes all the difference in this?
Your Honor, I trust that Ms. Taylor is going to explain to us what she sees there, but as far as I can tell from what Mr. Garner provides guidance is that in that final paragraph of A, we have two dependent clauses. If Deborah is not then legally alive and legally competent, then we progress to paragraph B. But, and this is important, it doesn't really matter if the court feels that B applies either way. Our opponents argue that they're entitled to to the assets at paragraph C at the end of Deborah's life. If in fact, a lifetime trust was established for her under B, even though she was not incompetent, at the end of that lifetime, in paragraph C, all of the assets go to the heirs at law of the Shorts. The heirs at law, and we've provided some guidance on that under paragraph C, the intestacy succession laws of Florida. The heirs at law are not defined in the trust. They're defined under Florida intestacy succession. The Shorts heirs at laws were to be determined at the mother's death. The decedent's death is the event that vests the heir's right to that property. Deborah survived both of her parents. She was her mother's descendant, so she was the heir at law, and we stopped there.
Why doesn't C mean that the remainder of the trust is distributed to the heirs at law that then exist upon Deborah's death?
Because it does not say that, Your Honor. And the general rule is that the heir's right vests at the death of the decedent, absent contrary to specific language, which was not the case in this case, been in all of the cases cited by appellees, was the case. There was specific language that carved that out. That's the general rule that's stated in the Craig case, the Texarkana Court of Appeals case that appellees cited, that just because a person is provided a lifetime estate, that does not preclude them from also participating in the remainder if they would also be an heir. We've provided at tab C, Florida authority that shows that that's also the general rule in Florida. And that case behind there, which is the Arnold case, shows an exception to that rule. In that case, it was determined that the life tenant's lifetime was the determining life because the only way that he took was if he, the life tenant, had natural heirs. And we couldn't tell that until he himself passed away. So the court decided that stated the general rule that the life tenant is not precluded from being an heir at law. They're vested at the time of the decedent's death, which in this case was back at paragraph A, where Deborah's mother died and she was alive. But in the Arnold case, he was excluded because of very specific language that isn't present here.
So what is the language in C where it says upon Deborah's death? I mean, what's the relevance of that?
Under the general rule, which is the rule in Texas and Florida, none. Because she is a life tenant, and at the end of her life, she also is an heir. And so only the distribution is delayed. She is vested at the time of her mother's death. And during her life, even assuming that that trust was in force, she could have directed her remainder interest in under C any way that she wanted to. If she'd had testamentary documents, she could have left that remainder interest to recovering circus elephants. So her remainder interest vested upon her mother's death, but the elephants would have to wait. Now, she did not have a will. And so when that occurs at the end of Deborah's lifetime, to determine who her heirs are, we would look to Texas intestate succession to find her heirs. But her remainder interest vested upon her mother's death.
So you all don't maintain that the trust is ambiguous?
Well, there are several places that if, in fact, it is not as we say, then I think that it is at best ambiguous. We've explained to the court that it is not a model of structural
clarity.
That's a
great argument. It's either what I say or it's ambiguous. I haven't heard that.
You know, Your Honor, I'm afraid that's the case in most contract cases. Everyone says it says what we say. And it is a little bit difficult to read. And we can see from some artifacts in the trust that there's some language that's sort of cut and pasted from other places. And we can see that we clearly don't have a direction under A. We say that there's an answer to that because we turn to intestate succession under either Florida or Texas law, so we do indeed have an answer.
And so without knowing how that affects us, at least three other courts have disagreed with that interpretation, right? The West Virginia lower appellate and then Judge Herman.
Well, Judge Herman did disagree with our interpretation, although we did not think that he had sort of given a holistic look at the trust. He has now informed us, since we filed our opening brief, that he has. The West Virginia court also was sort of taking a myopic view of what the trust said. And, of course, it's our contention that the West Virginia court had no business in this case to begin with. As you know, we filed a motion for rehearing there, and every justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court has now either been impeached, indicted, resigned, so we don't know what the outcome of that will be.
But they have some great furniture in the courthouse.
They do.
Can I ask you, before you run out of time, if we were to deny the leave to amend with regard to the sanctions order and adding the party, what would be the effect of that? Would we be able to reach the sanctions order? We have jurisdiction to do that?
I think that you do, Your Honor, and here's why. The Texas provides a very low bar for invoking appellate jurisdiction and a very flexible standard for amending or correcting, perfecting documents.
Does that include adding parties there?
Well, yes, I think it does, and it's, most cases have found that could be done. But here we have five factors that we've described to the court that Mr. Cortez can establish direct remediable harm to him. He specifically amended the original notice of appeal to add the sanction order. He specifically itemized the sanctions order in the docketing statement. I see my time has...
Go ahead.
Okay. He also expressly and fully and particularly briefed this issue in his opening brief. That was a determinative factor in the San Antonio Court of Appeals case that we've cited, Loeffler. And as soon as he became aware of the defect, he asked for leave to file an amended notice. And so we would say to the court that applying a per se procedural bar on these facts actually establishes a very heightened and inflexible standard, which is not consistent with Texas Supreme Court guidance on this issue. So we would encourage the court to reach this on the merits.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Vance. Morning, Ms. Taylor.
Good morning. May it please the court. The crux of Mr. Cortez's argument rests on a fallacy that this trust does not provide for a disposition of all remaining assets in the event that Deborah Cortez was living and competent at the time of her second parent's death. In this case, that is her mother, Phyllis. I'd like to start with paragraph B. As Justice Field mentioned, this paragraph is incredibly important in determining what happens in the event that Deborah Cortez was alive and competent. In the beginning, it has a global reference that says, if Deborah is then living. It doesn't have any qualifier. It doesn't say living and competent. It doesn't say living and incompetent. It doesn't say living and wearing only black to mourn her mother's death. There is no qualifier. It is just a global reference to Deborah surviving both of her parents. And the next three parts of paragraph B are equally instructive. I'd like to talk about a few portions that weren't mentioned in the opening argument. In B1, it talks about providing Deborah with income directly. That's assuming that she's competent, payments to Deborah. And then it says, or, quote, on her behalf if she becomes incapacitated. That's another reference to incompetent. So we're going to give Deborah income directly if she's competent, or on her behalf if she's incompetent. That dual reference is picked back up in paragraph B2 about the principal. Again, it refers to payments directly to Deborah or payments on her behalf. Again, paragraph B is providing for competent or incompetent. And then we get to the crux, B3, the intent, the express statement of intent. This is the pole star of trust interpretation. The shorts clearly provide. Their intent is to provide for Deborah during her life, again, the global reference. And then they say to Deborah or on her behalf. So we have a global reference to Deborah being alive, a dual reference to competent or incompetent. There is no reasonable way to argue that paragraph B fails to contemplate what happens if Deborah was alive and competent. All three paragraphs contemplate both. And if it were true that paragraph B did not provide for Deborah while she was alive and competent, then the court has to ask, why did Deborah Cortez take payments from the trust for the remainder of her life while she was alive and competent? That is reflected in the record. She was taking payments of the trust. Not only did she take payments, she individually set up an annuity for the trust to continue paying her on a quarterly basis. That's reflected in the record at pages 285 to 86 and 313 to 318. Deborah's signature is on the annuity that was set up to pay her during her life while she was competent. So her conduct certainly does not speak to paragraph B not applying. And Deborah's not here to tell us her intent, but Mr. Cortez still is, and his lawyers are. In their live pleading in this matter, his fourth amended pleading, Mr. Cortez has a claim saying that Deborah was entitled to more income during her life. He wants additional payments during Deborah's life while she was competent. If that is his claim, how can he now stand before the court and argue that B doesn't apply in the event that Deborah was competent?
Help me understand her rights vis-a-vis Section B. I mean, if we're under Section B, I'm trying to get a clear picture of which claims have been severed out and kept here and which claims have been gone. Basically, it's the claims between the heirs and Mr. Cortez that went one direction. The remaining claims are between the aunt, I can't recall her name, and Mr. Cortez for the money that he allegedly took. And then he, in that same vein, has these claims where they allege that she was entitled to something further under B, or that there could have been further principal distributions. Help me understand that.
Yes, Chief Justice Rose, there's a clear line of demarcation. Claims between Linda Murray as trustee and Mr. Cortez are about payments during Deborah's life, during her life. Claims between the heirs are truly, actually, the heirs have not asserted any claims. This is Mr. Cortez's declaratory judgment claim against the heirs, talking about what happens to the remaining assets after Deborah's death. So while of course they both arise under the trust, they are two separate sets of claims during Deborah's life and upon Deborah's death, who is entitled to the remaining assets. Also, the claims regarding the trustee Murray focus more on actual amounts, the math. It seems that Mr. Cortez in that capacity agrees that Deborah was entitled to money during her life under paragraph B while competent, and they're fighting about how much she should have been paid. Versus the heirs, we're talking about once we get to whatever those remaining assets are, however much is left, is Mr. Cortez the person as the representative of the estate who is entitled to 100% of those remaining assets, or should they be distributed amongst the heirs? That will require an heirship proceeding. That is something that will have to happen in West Virginia because that's where the rim of the trust is located. And so the actual math of the amounts is a separate issue.
And in that West Virginia proceeding to the assets of the trust, would Mr. Cortez, as representative of her estate, still have some sliver of a dog in that fight? I mean, whether it's some share as an heir, is he still in that one?
Well, of course, this court will make its ruling about the legal interpretation of the trust, and then West Virginia is an independent court. If it chooses to defer to the Texas court, this court's ruling may impact the West Virginia outcome. West Virginia might say, we reach our own conclusion. I think if you read their most recent opinion, they've indicated that they are deferring to the Texas court. And they have also indicated that they agree substantively that Mr. Cortez is not entitled to the remaining assets under the trust, but that decision remains for this court.
Do they have some sort of a stay in place on the assets, or are they potentially going to pay out?
There's a Rule 11 agreement in place that no distributions will be made until a final decision.
And then what is your position as to, I mean, they're very critical of the severance and the fact that the severance keeps the case from being decided here?
Yes, Your Honor. We see these as separate issues that can be tried separately, and importantly, the probate court has broad discretion in managing its own docket and determining for efficiency what matters should be severed. It has happened time and time again that upon a final summary judgment, the trial court will sever those claims out, allow them to go up on appeal for a final ruling, and that is what the Texas Supreme Court held in Cherokee Water. There, they said, even if it would have been preferable in some sense to try the two claims together, the trial court had discretion to sever the summary judgment for efficiency. I also would like to bring this court's attention to a case out of this court, the Schlapper versus Forrest case. This is 2010 Tex App Lexus 7037. There, Ms. Schlapper owned a piece of property out by Lake Travis, and she claimed that she also owned three adjoining lots that would give her direct access to the lake. A company, Harbor Ventures, claimed it owned the three adjoining tracks, and it wanted to start construction on those tracks. So Ms. Schlapper sued. She said, they're my tracks. Harbor Ventures says, nope, they're ours. So you've got two competing interpretations of real estate documents, kind of similar to what we have here. Ms. Schlapper asserted claims for slander of title. Harbor Ventures had a declaratory judgment and injunctive claim. This court held those could be severed, despite the fact that they came from the same real estate documents and would require a holistic interpretation of the deeds. The court felt for efficiency that the slander of title claims could go up on appeal and be finally disposed of, and then go back down and determine the declaratory and injunctive relief. So that opinion is very similar to the facts that we have here and shows that Judge Herman was within his discretion.
I guess speaking of Judge Herman's discretion, we might as well get into the sanctions issue.
Sure.
What's your position on the sanctions issue, and were the sanctions based on as narrow a set of conduct as it seems they were pled under the Section D, the 35-year-old provision?
First, our position, Your Honor, is that this court doesn't need to reach the merits because there was no notice of appeal filed on behalf of Mr. Brotherton. Given that that's not the basis of your question, I will let our briefing speak to that, but we think the law is pretty clear. Many, many opinions from this court have decided that direct issue. As far as the scope of the sanctions,
I guess
order,
on that issue, though, what's the harm if he's allowed to amend?
Well, harm is not the standard under the rule. The standard is a matter of procedure and making sure that we have rules that we all play by in the Court of Appeals. And the heirs were entitled to rely on the fact going into the appeal that Mr. Brotherton had not perfected his own appeal. You could imagine in any case that as an appeal is beginning, you are thinking settlement strategy, you are thinking long-term expense and planning. And when you have a notice of appeal that says we are taking up the issues of the trust interpretation and not planning to appeal the sanctions on behalf of Mr. Brotherton, you can rely on that. But frankly, the standard is a matter of procedure, and it wasn't complied with in this case. In any event, if you reach the merits, Judge Herman was well within his discretion. In response to your question, it's clear from the record at the sanctions hearing that the motion, the relief requested was based only on paragraph D, not on paragraph C. And contrary to what Ms. Vance told you, that paragraph D was never relied on as a standalone position, the pleadings speak for themselves. For 16 months, Mr. Cortez's claim was based only on paragraph D, the postponement provision, the under 35 provision. Paragraph C was not added as a basis for his relief until the fourth amended petition, and we've given the court a timeline as Exhibit A to our oral argument packet, and it's clear that it was 16 months after he intervened that he first based his argument on C. Then, of course, on appeal, we have a new argument that wasn't even raised at trial that's under paragraph A. So our argument on behalf of the heirs has been consistent, straight as an arrow, all the way through this case. Mr. Cortez has no legal entitlement to the remaining assets. Mr. Cortez's position has shifted and dodged at every single opportunity to raise a new argument. And even then, we say, that's fine. Go ahead and interpret the whole trust. That's what we asked Judge Herman to do. Look at the trust as a whole. We understand that you have de novo review. Paragraph A does not get him there. Paragraph B, nor C, nor D give Mr. Cortez an entitlement to the trust. And I do want to point some things out under paragraph C in my remaining time with the court's permission.
Just before you get there, it looked like Judge Herman was really basing his sanctions on the effect of West Virginia's ruling. And it looked like what his reward was the attorney's fees incurred since that. Is that a legitimate basis upon which a trial court can exercise its discretion, a non-final ruling from a court of, you know, the court whose jurisdiction is being questioned by the other side? Is that a sanctionable basis?
Judge Herman was not sanctioning Mr. Brotherton because West Virginia ruled against him. He was sanctioning Mr. Brotherton because West Virginia ruled against him, and then, and this is the important part, Mr. Brotherton did not come into Judge Herman's court with candor, explain that that ruling had been made, and make a good faith legal argument for why there should be a different outcome in Texas. When you have an adverse legal ruling on the exact legal issue, and you continue asserting the same argument without any basis for a different outcome, that is not good faith advocacy. That is harassment. That is something that has caused the heirs to continue to incur legal fees, time, and expense to continue combating the same argument that's already been shot down. We never argued, and Judge Herman certainly would not feel that the West Virginia order controlled him. I am confident that Judge Herman, with 35 years on the bench, can tell you that he made his own legal decision. And as the fact finder, having watched the entire history of the case and seeing the conduct of Mr. Brotherton throughout the proceedings, which he's entitled to consider under his abuse of discretion standard, Judge Herman, by the end of all of these proceedings, said that is a clear-cut, sanctionable argument. There was no good faith basis to make it. They stood on it for months and months. And then even after they were put on notice by the West Virginia court that as a matter of law, they were incorrect, they continued making the same argument without candor to the court. That is exactly the standard under Rule 10, or Chapter 10 of the CPRC.
He carved back on the sanctions amounts that were requested. Tell us about that process and how that reflects the validity of his sanctions order.
Yes, Your Honor. As in many cases that we've cited in our brief, the trial court did a good job in exercising his discretion. The heirs counsel requested a total of about $109,000. Judge Herman cut that in half, approximately down to $65,000. He said, first of all, I'm going to give them some leeway. I'm going to segregate all the amounts until after West Virginia ruled, because that's the point, if nothing else, that you should have come in here with some candor and you didn't do it. So he cut the sanctions in half starting at that point. Then he went through and made his own line item cuts just based on his 35 years on the bench and what he thought was reasonable. And of course, the heirs counsel would have liked a larger award, but that's the judge's discretion, not counsel's. So he cut it down an additional, I think, $12,000, because he took the time to go line by line through the attorney's fee invoices. And the case law, the Poole versus Diana case out of this court and others that we've cited, demonstrates that that kind of analysis by the trial court is exactly what we want before an attorney is sanctioned. He didn't just take at face value what the lawyer said. He went through and made his own independent determination of what was reasonable. Importantly, too, he did not sanction the second counsel, Mr. Sean Hester, because Judge Herman wanted to directly aim the sanctions at the culpable party. That was Mr. Brotherton. And so he denied the request for sanctions to the other lawyer, and we've cited case law that that also supports a finding that the court was within its discretion. In regard to paragraph C, I want to make sure the court is aware of its holding in Spate versus American National Bank. There we have a testatrix, if you'll excuse my Texan, Gladys. Gladys had a will that left everything through a trust. Almost identically to this case, Gladys said the trust provides for her two daughters during their life, and at the end of their life, the remainder shall go to her heirs at law. It did not say her surviving heirs at law or her then living heirs at law. It just said, trust to my daughters with the remainder to my heirs at law. The issue in that case was exactly the issue here. Are the heirs at law to be determined on the date of Gladys's death or on the date of the last surviving daughter? And this court said it is to be determined on the date of the last surviving daughter. Why? For the same reasons you should reach that holding here. The trust drew a clear line between the life gift and the remainder gift. This court said that it was evident from within the four corners of the trust that Gladys had an intention for there to be a difference. Lifetime gift to daughters, remainder to the heirs at law. She didn't need to put the word surviving heirs or then living heirs, because there was a difference between lifetime and a future interest. And the court looked to surrounding provisions, just like we have here. The reference to other beneficiaries in paragraph B3, the reference to beneficiaries under 35 in paragraph D. The court looked at those surrounding provisions and said that also provides context for understanding that heirs at law had to be determined at the death of the second surviving daughter. And the court said these other provisions would be a, quote, waste of words if we were to say that the heirs at law were determined upon Gladys's death. There would be no reason to have provided for all of these other things if the intent was to give 100% to the daughters. Same here. If what the Shorts wanted to do was vest 100% of the trust assets in Deborah, they could have done that in one sentence. We wouldn't need all of the comprehensive distribution scheme that we see in B, C, and D. They would have said, we're supporting our churches in West Virginia, Florida, and Texas, and then everything to Deborah. But that's not what they did. They set out a comprehensive scheme that Mr. Cortez wants this court to strike through, render totally meaningless. Ms. Vance even acknowledged that the introductory sentence of C would be meaningless under their interpretation, and instead resort to the rules of intestacy. Your Honors, the law abhors intestate succession. When settlers like the Shorts have taken the time to execute a comprehensive estate plan, you do not throw it out the window and resort to intestate succession unless there is no other reasonable interpretation of the trust. The heirs have presented you with an interpretation of the trust that relies on the plain language, follows governing legal principles, and results in a comprehensive distribution of all remaining assets. Mr. Cortez asks you to resort to intestacy right through provisions of the trust and render meaningless add words in that don't exist. In paragraph B, he wants you to add in the phrase only if incompetent in all three provisions. The court just cannot do that. Finally, I will mention there is a statute in Florida, section 736.1106, that we've cited in our brief that is directly in line with the common law principles that we've been talking about. The distribution date of a future interest, this is the future interest in remaining assets, is set on the date that the future interest is to take effect. Paragraph C says, upon Deborah's death. That tells us that the distribution date is on the death of the last of the three lifetime beneficiaries to die, William, Phyllis, or Deborah. They could die in any order. But on the last date of death for the three of them, we turn to the future interest, the remaining assets. Those go to the heirs at law. And 736.1106 part 2 says the contingent beneficiary must survive the distribution date. Deborah cannot survive her own death, so she cannot be the sole heir. I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Last word, Ms. Vance.
Well, that's a lot. Let me begin at the end. The statute that Ms. Taylor just cited to you, I would ask the court to look at that because it's only effective at a certain date, and it does not apply to wills that were irrevocable as of that date, which at least applies to William Short's portion of this trust because he died in 2002. The effective date of that statute is much later. So certainly it doesn't apply to his part, and whether it applies under the facts of the cases that we've shown you, the court will determine. I'd like to briefly mention the Spate case that Ms. Taylor referred to. The Spate case is almost identical to the Arnold case because in this case, the two daughters that were given the life estate were expressly treated differently than the remainder class. They were only to take a specified amount if they had natural issue, if they had issues born of their body. So they were carved out from the remainder class just as the grandson was in Arnold. It's a very different circumstance. Absent that sort of language, I think the outcome would have been different there because we know the general rule is that the life tenant is not excluded. Ms. Taylor said that they could die in any order. Well, that, of course, is not true. If Deborah were dead before her parents, we know that we didn't ever reach her. We didn't get to her. She had to be alive to survive her parents, or we go straight to the heirs. There was no one there. Because she did not, her remainder interest vested upon the death of her mother. I'd like to briefly talk about the severance, and just very briefly. What's left in the trial court, the claim to income was an alternative claim. Deborah was entitled to all of it. If she wasn't entitled to all of it, she was at least entitled to income. That's still sitting in the trial court, and essentially nothing is happening on that because we don't know. If she was entitled to all of it, then she didn't need the income. The same is true also of the misappropriation. If she was entitled to those trust assets, she couldn't have misappropriated from herself. All of those are still sitting down there, which shows us that what we really have here is an interlocutory appeal, which wasn't perfected as such. It was just lopped off and severed. Otherwise, things would be proceeding down there. These are things that are dependent. I think it's very important on all of these issues to consider, and we've explained to the court, how the West Virginia case came to be. Ms. Murray, who's the trustee, but is also one of the potential beneficiaries, the third-party defendants, as they've labeled themselves the heirs, filed this suit. She affirmatively invoked the exclusive jurisdiction of this court, claiming in rem jurisdiction. And then many months later, and their timeline is wrong on this, many months later, she filed another suit. Now, Ms. Taylor would like to draw a line between deciding who gets the money on the one hand and deciding who doesn't on the other. But that is not true. Those issues as to who was entitled to the money would, could, and should have been decided in this court. The third-party defendants were brought in, the heirs, as they call themselves, to this court. They are subject to the jurisdiction of this court. The West Virginia court had no business being in this. And the sanctions order was squarely based on that West Virginia court ruling. Ms. Taylor does not shrink from that. They've said in their motion for summary judgment, the judge said in his order, their brief is littered with the fact that Mr. Brotherton should have known for two reasons. That he could have read the trust and known it was wrong. Well, that's clearly silly. None of us can quite figure out what it is. That's what we're here about. But he should have known he was wrong because the West Virginia court that Ms. Murray had run up and started a second file suit unnecessarily and gotten a ruling from them said so. And that cannot be the case that a Texas court, first of all, has to bow to that, and secondly, that a litigant in that circumstance can just have an end around done. In my very brief remaining time, I would like to say about the language in paragraph 3. Everything in paragraph 3 modifies the incompetency trust. We don't get there. Here's the canary in the coal mine. What meaning does the $50,000 gift have if their interpretation is true? We only give the $50,000 gift to a living, legally competent Deborah. But if we're going to get to B, we take it away. Why would that be if she's also legally competent and living or not under B? It means that $50,000 specific cash gift has no meaning whatsoever, and we would urge the court to find our interpretation under A is correct, but in any event, the outcome is the same under paragraph C. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vance. Ms. Taylor, well-argued case, interesting issues. The case will be submitted. Courts can take that brief recess and allow the parties in the next case to take their seats and our students, I think, to come in. So court stand on short recess.